Civilization exists by geological consent, subject to change without notice. You are listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Professor Dave, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. Today's opening quote was from Will Durant's 1946 essay, What is Civilization? When we look into Earth's distant past, we observe that some of the biggest events leading to the evolution of humanity were giant impacts. When we look into our future, we certainly hope there are no such impactors on their way. Nonetheless, the study of craters on Earth has helped to shape our understanding of the history of our solar system, our planet, and ourselves. The Earth was born in a time called heavy bombardment, when asteroid and comet debris littered the solar system, repeatedly smashing the face of every planet and moon. Our moon seems to have been born when a particularly huge impactor, perhaps the size of Mars, smashed into the nascent Earth, scattering molten debris into space. Some of that material eventually coalesced into the moon, which then took its place next to us in the cosmic shooting gallery. Much of this grand story was influenced by the data gained by dating moon rocks brought back by the Apollo missions. By determining when impacts, both big and small, have happened here and on the moon, we learn about our history. To tell us a little bit about dating craters and the science of geochronology, our guest today is Kelsey Young from Arizona State University. Enjoy the interview by Raymond Francis.
So, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. Among other things, you work in geochronology and the dating of terrestrial impact craters.
That's correct.
How do you do that? How does that work?
Well, it depends on the technique that you're using. So there's been several techniques historically that have been used to date craters. Among them that are some of the techniques that I work on is argon 4039. That results from the decay of potassium to argon. But most of what my dissertation at Arizona State University focuses on is uranium, thorium, helium thermochronology. Whereas argon 4039 can mostly rely on dating impact melts that are produced directly during the impact event. What uranium, thorium, helium thermochronology is all about is dating zircon or apatite or titanite grains that existed prior to the impact that were shocked in the impact event, and the high temperatures and pressures associated with the impact caused them to lose all of their helium, and the thermochronometric clock was reset, and that's what we ended up dating in our lab.
So these are pairs of radioisotopes, one that decays into the other?
That's correct. So uranium and thorium decay to lead, and along the way, there are eight steps that produce the lead isotopes that actually are measured in uranium lead, but we look at the helium-4 alpha particles that are spewed off in that decay chain.
And would be trapped in the material if
you
weren't heated up.
So it's a noble gas, so it's not it's trapped within the crystal structure. It's not actually an atom within the crystal structure.
And so how does that get reset?
Basically, what we think is going on is that the high temperatures and pressures flash open the crystal structure, so all the helium-4 gas that was previously trapped in the mineral grain escapes as a gas into the atmosphere. And then when the temperature and pressure come back down to a more normal level, not necessarily all the way down to base level, but even just enough that the crystal structure closes, that helium-4 clock is reset to zero and then it starts accumulating again.
As things continue to decay after the resetting.
That's correct, yes.
Okay. And so you're going to measure the relative proportions of the different decay isotopes to get an age?
That's correct, yes, okay. Using Dodson's age equation.
Which is, this is the basic equation of this kind of work?
That's correct, yes.
This, I guess, is comparable to the carbon dating that people would be more familiar with.
Yeah, isotopic dating, all kind of, you know, the basic principles are that something decays to something else. In our case, two things decay to something else. And sometimes you measure that original daughter product to the parent product, but what we measure is actually something that is created in the process of parent to daughter. So we call helium-4 a daughter, but it's lead that's the real true daughter product of
the actual decay goes to lead, but it lets out this
helium-4
this helium nucleus. So what's the utility of uranium-thorium compared to other?
I mentioned earlier that argon-4039 is quite useful in dating impact melt, because sometimes what you don't actually know with thorium-helium is that whether a grain was completely 100% reset as opposed to partially reset. So argon 4039 has these benefits in that you know you're dating melt, which was produced directly in the impact event. No questions asked. Euthorium helium, however, is advantageous at craters like Hotten Crater in the High Arctic and Devon Island in that there wasn't a lot of impact melt produced. So if you can't date impact melt, there really is no other option other than to use this whole grain technique that we do in grain euthorium helium.
So if you can identify rocks that were formed in melting in the crater, mm-hmm. you can use the argon method.
Or by the same token, for dating mastacid impact crater, we actually use zircons that were found in the melt that we think were still there prior to the impact of the melt kind of picked up in its formation.
So what are the zircons?
Zircons are a mineral grain, ZrSiO4.
Okay.
So it's a silicate mineral that has zirconium in it. And it has, basically, it's a mineral that has a lot of uranium and thorium to start with. So it has enough helium-4 that's produced to actually measure appreciable amount so we can date it.
And it would have been in the rock before the impact.
That's correct.
And survived.
Yeah. They're often found in intrusive rocks, granitic rocks mostly, which mastacid and Hotten thankfully have.
How accurate can the uranium, thorium, and helium method be?
It depends on several things. Your lab instrumentation, as well as how you play your statistics after you've gotten the measurements. So we are very careful in our lab, so our errors are a bit higher than some other reported errors in the literature because we take our errors that come out from each instrument. So basically with euthorium helium, you measure the helium on one instrument and then you dissolve the grain because helium-4 is a gas, so as soon as you heat it up, the gas escapes. But the uranium and thorium are actually trapped in the crystal structure, so you need to actually dissolve the grain to get at how much uranium and thorium is in there. So you actually introduce a second type of mass spectrometer to measure the uranium and thorium. So that's two different instruments for errors to get introduced to your measurement. So the initial error we get from all measuring uranium, thorium, and helium involves two different mass specs. And then what we do is, depending on how big the spread of the data is, which generally is quite large with impact dating because you do have the spread of only partially reset grains amongst your data set, is actually apply a number of other statistical methods to it to account for that scatter, as well as our analytical uncertainties in our data. So we get within 1-2%.
And for the craters you're talking about, mastacid, for example, how old are these terrestrial craters?
There's a widespread in those as well, but the two that I personally have worked on are Hotten and mastacid. And Hotten, there was an age discrepancy published in the literature before. Several studies published an age of about 22 or 23 million years old, and a much later study published an older age of about 39 million. But our study reversed that age back to an age about 23.5 million years old. And then we dated mastacid impact crater through zircons we found on the impact melt, and we got an age of about 35.75 million years old.
So a couple of percent makes a big difference. But
right. So our age for mastacid was 35.75 plus or minus one, about one. So not
1 million
bad.
Year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Which on geological times is
yes.
not a big deal.
Drop in the bucket.
And are these the kind of techniques that you would use if you were going to try to date craters if we went to the moon or Mars?
So that's a really interesting question that our lab group at Arizona State is trying to address. It's a tough question to work out because on the moon there are craters on top of craters on top of craters, and a lot of the kind of rubble and regolith on top of the moon is getting thrown around and impacted by multiple different events. So one rock could theoretically hold a signature of dozens even of impact events. So how you pick out the signatures from each event is challenging, especially when you have impact craters of different sizes that introduce different amounts of heat and pressure to the system. So we are trying right now to date lunar samples from Apollo 16 and 17 in our lab. I personally am not working with the samples, but several people at ASU are, and they're having some success. We haven't quite found any zircons. We can do in situ zircon dating as well. We haven't found any datable phases in the sections we have so far, but we're still looking. And we're also going to do some in-situ argon-argon work on those sections.
How does the in-situ stuff work? You don't destroy the material? Or?
You do. So you basically, instead of having what I do for the impact crater stuff, at least so far, is dissolve whole grain. So you have just a discrete isolated zircon grain that you heat up to get the helium and then dissolve to get the uranium and thorium. But actually for the in-situ work, we use laser ablation ICP-MS. So actually dissolve just a small spot size on the surface of the grain or in a thick section or whatever material you're analyzing.
And the material, is it vaporized by the laser?
Yes, it's vaporized. So it's a small spot size. Depending on how old you think your sample is, what ballpark it's in, you change your spot size based on how much gas you think you need to analyze to get a signal to bring down your error. So for example, at a crater that's about as old as mastacid, right around 36 million years old, you'd probably have to have a spot size of about 20 microns.
Oh, that's not very much.
No.
Okay.
So you can really get a look at if you have, let's say you want to do in situ analyses on one zircon grain, you can look at several spots in that zircon and see if there's any zoning, because uranium and thorium are known to be zoned in zircons. So you can look at how, if there's age zoning, if maybe the rim of the crystal is completely reset, whereas the core is partially reset. So those are the types of things that I'm actually going to be working on in the next year or two.
And so this is all done in laboratory facilities with big, heavy mass spectrometers,
yes,
kind of tools? Okay.
Yes.
And are there ways to start interrogating this out in the field?
I don't think the instrumentation's quite there yet. Our lab doesn't work on these types of issues, but I know at the Lunar and Planetary Science Conference, there were several posters on developing mass spectrometers for planetary missions for rovers to take with them. So they just need to have the capabilities to measure the isotopes that are ablated off of the sample. I don't think we'll ever have the ability to do, or at least not for quite a long time, to do the whole grain dating, because you have to get the grains out of the rock somehow. So what we do in our lab is a process that takes a week or two to isolate one zircon grain from a bulk rock sample that you collect in the field. But the in situ dating has more promise, I think, and I think we'll get there.
But you also work with some instruments that you take into the field to study rocks.
I do. I'm working on my PhD right now at Arizona State, and half of my dissertation work involves this impact crater dating, and the other half is quite different and involves working with a handheld X-ray fluorescence spectrometer that's actually used to get chemical compositions from a rock. And so we're looking at the utility of that in planetary exploration missions by exploring it in analog environments on Earth.
So what is X-ray fluorescence?
That involves basically an X-ray source that's in your instrument that you're using, and you send it into, actually we just present, it looks like a little X-ray gun or a price scanning gun, and you hold it up to a sample, and theoretically you need it touching the window to actually make this work. So you send in incident X-rays to the sample, it interacts with the electron shells around each atom, which sends out characteristic X-rays that are characteristic of each specific element, and the instrument has a count of how many, of what the wavelength of the X-rays is that's coming back out, and we measure that and then back out chemical compositions from that.
And so the frequencies of the X-rays that come back out are diagnostic of the,
correct,
the atoms that are,
yes,
wrong. How useful is it?
It is useful. The one downside I will say is that it's not good at measuring light elements. So anything that's basically lighter than magnesium can't be picked up because the energy coming back out isn't strong enough to make it back to the detector. But so most major elements and all minor elements are picked up by the XRF. And we've done a lot of work with calibrating it to samples that have been run on laboratory-sized XRFs that we know are reliable to see how well those numbers compare. And we're finding that they really do compare quite well, certainly in the lab. And we're doing more investigations right now to figure out how much, if any, sample preparations required in the field to get the same caliber of measurement.
So is that something that could it conceivably be used on a small rover mission?
It could, yeah. Uh-huh. And I've actually deployed the XRF in several different robotic environments. I've used it myself in the field as a pretend astronaut walking around in a terrestrial analog environment, but I've also put it on a couple robots. I worked with a group from NASA Ames who have a K-10 rover that we took up to the Hot Mars project on Devon Island, and we put the XRF on the back of the rover, mm-hmm, so it would drive up to a place that we were interested in, and it would lower the XRF to touch the surface. There are, which is great, it's a lot of data that's coming back, but we need to figure out the best way to present the sample that we're interested in to the XRF window, because it's quite hard to get good sample presentation. And without that sample presentation, the energy coming back just doesn't make it to the detector.
So you need to have the device right up against the face of the,
mm-hmm,
block?
Pretty close, yeah, a couple millimeters.
Yeah, and I can see robotically accurate placement of,
right,
the device against something that you can't run into.
Right. You can imagine a sort of NASA Constellation mission-style architecture where astronauts are living near or on a body for weeks at a time, where basically the astronauts doing spacewalks around the surface collect a bunch of samples and basically get kind of like a chain reaction going through the XRF, where you measure one, move on, measure another, move on. And we've played around with the acquisition times of this type of data, and what we found is ideally one sample is presented to the instrument window for about 1 minute, and that's enough to get a good characterization of the sample surface.
So you mentioned testing these as a pretend astronaut. What were you doing?
The idea is that actually in Apollo we had one trained geologist go to the moon. The rest of the Apollo astronauts received intensive geologic training, but we had one, you know, classically trained geologist go to the moon, and it makes a big impact on traverse activities and EVA or spacewalk activities. And so myself and several other people in the NASA and CSA are working on basically experimenting with these issues. And is it helpful to have a geologist in the field as opposed to a pilot? And what can they do to increase situational and geologic awareness of a site? And with that comes testing geochemical instruments and other sample collection technologies to see what's useful, what's not, what should we take if we ever go back to the moon or Mars or an asteroid.
And what kind of tests were you doing out in the...
Well, so at Mustaston Lake Impact Structure, I was working with a group from Western, mm-hmm, and we were basically testing a rover, as well as we had two other geologists who pretended to be astronauts walk around the surface. So we did a lot of cool stuff up at Mustaston Lake. In the past, I've been involved with a couple other analog tests. Like I said, I went up to Hot and Mars project with a K-10 rover to be kind of an on-site science team. And then the two kind of quote-unquote astronaut tests I've done, there's one, Arizona State University actually built a small recon or robotic assist vehicle to help with astronaut activities on the surface of another planet. And University of Maryland came out with us, and we went out in the field in Arizona and drove around the rover and put on some simulated spacesuits and basically were interrogating the robotic assist vehicle to see, is it helpful to have a little rover driving behind you when you're on a spacewalk to collect, you know, store your samples so you don't have to hold them, and store your XRF if you want one on EVA. But then I also participated in the NASA Desert Rats Field Test, which is research and technology studies, in 2010 as a crew member. So I lived in their Habitat rover, their space exploration vehicle, for 7 days, 7 nights, and we did a series of about 3-ish spacewalks per day, simulated spacewalks, where a team of geologists designed a traverse plan for the rover to drive around and look at. And we were interrogating a series of cinder cones and associated lava flows in northern Arizona. So we had a suite of sample collection technologies and actually a habitat lab that we could examine the samples after we collected them. So the XRF, we had that up there. And we also had sample collection technology similar to what the Apollo astronauts used on the moon.
So that's quite a variety of tests.
Yes.
Did you learn anything interesting about the way you need to operate in this kind of...
Oh, definitely. Tests? A lot of what we were looking at in Desert Rats was we had actually two rovers that were driving around simultaneously in the area. And we did... So I was in for 7 days, and 3 of those days we did both rovers together in constant communications with the back room. Mm-hmm. And so we were looking at the interplay of... Each rover had two crew members, and we were talking to each other and talking to the back room. And then the second 3 days we did, we actually ceased communications with the back room. We talked to them in the morning and at night. So they would say, we'd really love for you to do this traverse plan. Let us know how it goes. Let us know if you see anything we didn't expect from remote sensing data. And so the two rovers would travel around kind of simultaneously and talk to each other and work out some of these geologic problems together, and then call back to Mission Control at the end of the day and get some feedback and get some help from the science team back on Earth that we're have been reviewing the data. So we learned a lot about communications with each other and with the back room. And we were also investigating what types of technologies that are really the most useful for kind of astronaut geologists to use on other planets. So we learned a lot about what type of rock hammer is easiest to hold, and, you know, what type of sample scoop, if you're sampling soil, is the best kind of configuration for an astronaut who's wearing a bulky suit to use. And I think it really helped the tools and technologies branches at NASA to kind of move forward in developing these kinds of things.
Did you find a big difference between the continual contact with Mission Control and morning and evening check-ins?
Definitely. It's, you know, there, as with anything, there are advantages and disadvantages to each technique. For example, when we had continuous communications with the back room, we weren't talking to the other rover as much, just because we had this other big group back on Earth to kind of bounce ideas off of. By the same token, that second 3 days when we weren't able to talk to the back room as much, there was a geologist in each rover, myself in one and another geologist in the second rover, and we were able to talk to each other more. And since we were kind of seeing similar things, we could discuss it as the day went on, and it was a more efficient way, at least less time-consuming way, to kind of touch base every few minutes and say, you know, I'm seeing this. Do you see any rock types on your end that look like this? And we compare notes like that. But continuous comms with the back room is great because you have a whole team supporting you and you can ask questions, and there's always going to be an expert in that back room that knows what you're talking about and can help you out. So there are definitely advantages to both.
It sounds like you're covering the sort of planetary exploration from every side here, the very fine geological science and the operations and the tools. So what's next?
Good question. I'm really interested in the impact cratering work that I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I'm definitely going to pursue some of the in-situ dating techniques I talked about. Definitely some in-situ zircon and hopefully apatite dating, which is another accessory mineral that you can use to date impact craters. And also some in-situ argon-4039 dating. I'm also definitely going to pursue the analog mission testing. NASA's kind of in a lull just in this year in terms of this calendar year. There's not a lot of analog testing going on. But I've done it in the past, and I'll definitely continue to work on it. It's exciting stuff.
Great. Well, good luck with it.
Thank you.
And we may cross paths again.
Yes, I hope so.
Thanks.
You are listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So Kelsey has quite a PhD project covering the whole range of things, right? From very fine analytical work up to operations and everything in between. And certainly something that requires attention to detail with this geochronology that she's doing. I think what really struck me in particular is just how precise and how careful that work has to be, and how she has to select one or another technique for radioisotope dating to try and understand this crater or that crater, depending on what materials are still preserved. You know, we hear a lot about carbon dating or radioisotope dating, and it's obscured just how much detail there is behind that.
Yeah, when we go into the classrooms, we really get asked on how do we date these craters and why are they so important, you know, dating them, even just here on Earth, to understand the whole evolution, or maybe if life came, you know, through one of these craters, or it created the conditions needed for life to rise. So yeah, we really get like asked a lot of times, and why do we actually study craters, or why do we actually date them?
And it's interesting to hear just how difficult a puzzle that is to dissect, right? Because it's not just a question of, you know, when they do carbon dating, you make the assumption that a living object, a piece of wood or something, takes up carbon from the environment at the environmental mix of isotopes. And then one of them, the C14, decays. And so that changes the ratio inside the object, and you can measure that. And, you know, if you can make that initial assumption about what the initial ratio is, the math is fairly easy. But with this uranium-thorium dating and some of these other techniques that she discusses, sometimes the clock is not fully reset. It's only partially reset because it depends on heat causing the escape of the helium. And so you only get a partial resetting. You get this noise in the signal. Some of the grains are fully reset, some are not. Are they not? And it's fortunate that we have alternate techniques if you have some of the right materials available in the crater. At the other end of the scale, of course, we got analog missions and mission operations. And she certainly had a lot of adventures with that stuff.
So you have worked a lot with the XRF. You actually hold a license to use that. So would you like to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's true. Canada is one of the very few places where you actually need a license to operate that kind of device because it generates X-rays. And so, you know, you should be expected to handle it properly. So they give you licenses. It's part of the analog mission work that we did here at Western. And it's the same device that Kelsey uses for her thesis work. But basically, you know, if you had it in the lab, you'd just place your rock sample inside and it would shoot some X-rays into it. And as she says, it raises electrons up to next orbitals and then lets them fall back down. And the emission from that is what you get. It's diagnostic of the types of atoms you have in there. But the fun thing about the field portable XRF is basically you have this X-ray gun that you can carry around and zap rocks, and it tells you pretty quickly what it's made of. And as she says, it's reasonably accurate. You can certainly get an elemental composition enough that tells you that this is a silicate or a carbonate rock or something else. It's fun, and it's something that's, compared to a lot of other tools, relatively easy to make portable, it seems, and so we get to use it in the field. We were testing it, and this is also what Kelsey's work has been in, is testing it as a tool for mobile operations on the surface of field geology, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was interesting that she was talking about how they tested it on robotics and how it wasn't exactly the easiest thing to use with them because you have to get in with a certain, she said it, what, a couple millimeters of the surface?
Yeah.
She called it the good sample presentation.
That's right.
The words used, but basically you have to, you know, it has to be at a certain angle and certain distance away and you know, getting robots to do that, even though that sounds like an easy task, is actually fairly difficult to do because you don't want it to get it too close that it breaks it, right?
That's right.
And then too far away, you're not going to get a good spectrum. So it's interesting how she was saying that that's actually very difficult, and that gives us actually a lot of motivation maybe to think about sending humans on these missions because, of course, we can do that very easily. It's not difficult for us to do that. And so how she was talking about how it's useful to have both geologists, specifically in humans there, as well as robotics on these missions.
Yeah, and that's an interesting division there. First, the division between robots and humans, and then between the kinds of humans you send, right?
Mm-hmm.
As she mentioned, through all the Apollo missions, there was only one of those astronauts who was a trained geologist.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of them were pilots and the like who had been given some geology training. Probably to the great exasperation of the geology instructor. I know that the geologists here have been very patient with me, but it's, you know, and you imagine going to the moon and or somewhere else, and what do you have? Who do you have to take pictures and samples for you? Is it just a robot proxy? Is it a pilot who, you know, you really better hope that you've given him the right impression about what's an interesting rock and what's a boring one?
Right, and when you're going to, say, the moon or Mars, I mean, let's face it, it's rock. right? Yep. It's all rock. It's not like there's trees and grass and water. I mean, geologist really seems to be the ideal person.
If you're going to pick a scientist to go, absolutely.
I think that's one of the reasons why she wanted to study this. This is part of her thesis, right? Because she wants, really part of her thesis is to determine whether these good XRFs enough are good instruments to use in missions and whether they can be used by space robotics. But I don't think she was saying, yeah, we could maybe try to put one on a, she said, actually, that's what it was. She said that they, when they were doing a run, with one of the Earth rovers that they tested it, didn't they? And that's when she said that they don't get really get great spec.
What are the other, you know, interesting outcomes from those analog tests? Is that whole question of depending on who and what you have on site, what's the relationship between the actors on site and the support back on Earth?
Right, which changes drastically, apparently, with who you can communicate with at the time, right? So when we think about sending people to the moon, you can have almost real-time comms with people back on Earth. But if you're sending people to Mars, that's, you know, difficult. We've talked about this in some of our previous interviews with some of the people who do analog work here. And so if you're on Mars, you're probably going to be talking more to the other people.
Yeah, and you're going to have to be organized in such a way that you can be effective when you're working independently of your distant support.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's going to be from a few to a few dozen minutes for one-way radio signals to get between Earth and Mars. And you know, you can't send a signal to Earth and say, all right, what do you want me to do next? And then wait 40 minutes for them to get it, make a decision, and 40 more minutes for them to send an answer. You can't do that.
Yeah, that's not the most efficient use of time, especially if you're in the field for, say, 4 to 6 hours, right?
Yeah.
You're not going to be able to do much. So the whole, here's the traverse we want you to try to do today, you know, let us know how it goes. But the nice thing about having a human being there instead of just a robotic mission is that they can make decisions as they're doing the traverse, right?
They can act and react tactically to
So they could go, well, that's not looking as interesting as this direction, so we're going to go in this direction instead. And then they could always backtrack as well, right? Which is something that's been talked about, how that doesn't happen very much in robotic missions.
Yeah. Well, and the thing, of course, with the human missions is they probably will be backtracking a lot because they have to go back to where their bed is.
Most likely the geologists won't be coming back, because it's kind of difficult to get them back. If we send a geologist there, they probably want to bring back some samples, and then you got to take that into consideration. That's extra weight, right?
That's
human, so human geologists is kind of difficult, so robotics will be the best way until we figure out how to get to Mars and back reliably.
Yeah, there's a lot of politics and a lot of money involved in sending humans, right? Yeah. Does the benefits outweigh the costs of that?
And also, should public or some public will support and some public will against, and there will be a huge protest.
Well, that happens all the time.
All the time.
Ignore that.
I mean, there is a value proposition being made there, and you have to factor whatever's coming back in the design of the mission. Actually, when you work out using the rocket equation, when you work out the design and the sizing of a mission to another body, the amount, the mass of stuff that you lift off the other body is the number one driver of the overall size and cost of the mission. So you're right. Geologists are the worst people to travel with. Because their souvenirs
are
piles of rocks. And they expect you to carry them.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Parshadi Patel and Michael Forrester and featured an interview by co-host Raymond Francis. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Raymond Francis, Alyssa Gilbert, Zengi Hu, and Parshadi Patel. Our editors were Anna Noon, Parshadi Patel, and Michael Forrester, and I'm Dave Kirsch. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, www.cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are @WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are www.facebook.com/westernworlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you can join us again next week, right here on astronomy.fm.